alongside our inner-city youth, hauling worms and compost. The corporation also sent us $100 each time one of their employees volunteered. This seemed unfair. We were getting free labor and money. I spoke to John Foget, the vice president for corporate sustainability at Kohl's, and said I wanted to form a closer relationship. I didn't want Kohl's just to throw money at us and then move on. I asked him how we could do more work together. John mentioned that Kohl's had green space adjacent to its large parking lot, and I went out to visit. My staff and I soon created a small garden in a median of the parking lot. We built a separate garden next to the daycare center that Kohl's provided for its employees. The children of Kohl's employees soon were learning to harvest and plant food. We opened a small farmer's market on Friday in the corporate cafeteria so that employees could buy fresh food before they went home for the weekend. The cafeteria staff at Kohl's began setting aside all of its food waste, except the meat, and we started composting it. This was a productive partnership in all aspects. In 2010, regional executives at Walmart toured my facility, and they began to have similar conversations with me about how we might work together. They said that Walmart was launching a new initiative intended to increase the amount of local food it bought by 2015 to 9%. This is not insignificant, especially for a company with Walmart's buying power. The average American eats less than 1% of his or her food from local sources. Representatives of the company also said it was investing $1 billion in its supply chain to better accommodate perishable and local food, and that it would commit $1 billion in its new markets to buy from farmers who grew on fewer than 50 acres. I was not unaware of the reputation that Walmart had in the progressive community. For years, Walmart has been viewed as undercutting small businesses with its pricing, making it difficult for family businesses to survive. The addition of supermarkets to Walmart megastores in the mid-1990s has made the corporation the largest food retailer in the United States, and the company has undoubtedly contributed to a decades-long trend that has made it difficult for smaller grocers and a regional food system to thrive. In essence, Walmart seemed to be for everything that I was against, yet I have always been a pragmatist. Jerry Kaufman, my board president, once framed a question to a group of planners that also informs my own thinking about Walmart or its competitors. How do we deal with the industrial agricultural system? Jerry asked. Are we going to take the position that we want it to go away? Or do we recognize that it's still a 900-pound gorilla in the living room and that it won't go away, but that maybe we can change its ways? Simply wishing Walmart gone is not going to make it go away. Many low-income people shop there because the prices are what they can afford, and these people don't have the luxury to consider the social implications of a big-box store economy. If Walmart was trying to buy more local food, I was willing to partner with them to try to make that happen. The whole work of my life has been trying to leverage people's strengths. This view has informed not only how I deal with people, but also how I work with corporations who are made up of people. My relationship with Walmart began when they agreed to give me 70,000 pounds of organic waste a week from 10 local stores. I did not have enough space to compost so much waste on Silver Spring Drive. One of my staff members was able to appeal to a Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District plant that had a vacant field, and we began each week to ship the 35 tons of Walmart food waste there, where we mix it with wood chips from the city of Milwaukee and other paper waste. I set up 9 new hoop houses within a mile of this composting facility, and we are now growing fresh greens year-round, primarily from Walmart waste. When you fly out of Milwaukee's Mitchell Airport, our composting operation is visible from the air. In 2011, executives at Walmart told me that they wanted to give Growing Power $1 million to help strengthen our dozen existing regional training centers, as well as to build 3 more, where others could learn our sustainable growing techniques. I gratefully accepted this grant without hesitation. I knew the money would permit more local food to get to more people. It would permit Dorothy Grady Scarborough in Mississippi, for instance, to close a deal on a 2-acre farm and have a commercial kitchen for her organization for the first time. I held a press conference in September of 2011 at Growing Power's headquarters to announce the grant. the news prompted the largest wave of criticism I have ever experienced in any of my careers. On the website Civil Eats, Andy Frischer, who served for many years as the director of the National Community Food Security Coalition, denounced our willingness to take Walmart's money by saying that we in the movement don't have to define our game as including those entities whose practices undermine our long-term goals. Many of my supporters wrote me to say that they understood why I took the grant, but they felt my choice was not in the spirit of our organization or my values. Some progressive writers who did not know me were less diplomatic. The Allen example already looks like yet another in the long, dreary menagerie of sellouts, said one. Others accused the Walmart Corporation of buying my silence and said that the grant was simply corporate greenwashing, an attempt to make the corporation look like an environmental steward by throwing money at a good cause, while their real intentions were to carry on business as usual. I think progressive critics of corporate business practices play a vital and important part in creating social change. In the absence of effective government, activist citizens and journalists need to take matters into their own hands. They need to point out injustice where they see it. The criticisms of Walmart have often been just, and it is also fair to criticize me. When Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of the arc of history being long, though, he was right. The current food distribution system is so entrenched that it is going to take decades to modify it. In the short term, we need to work with the institutions that we have. If Walmart wants to buy more local food and to invest in local farmers, I am going to meet that gesture in good faith. To some, the more troubling question that the Walmart donation to Growing Power raised was whether the urban agriculture movement could be economically sustainable without outside funding. This is an important question to confront directly. To motivate young people to be farmers now, says Dorothy Grady Scarborough in Mississippi, they are going to have to see the money first. We have to be able to lay this out and say that with this amount of acreage, you can make this certain amount of money if you follow these guidelines. The honest truth is that with urban agriculture, we are not there yet. We have not yet made it reliably profitable. I think we can, though. I see my own work as part of a long continuum. Every industry needs investment in basic research. The industrial agricultural system in this country has been sustained only through billions of annual subsidies and the government's historical investment in irrigation systems and technology suited to large-scale farming. All of the experiments that we have tried at Growing Power, and most recently our work with solar and geothermal heat, have been an attempt to drive down the costs of production for small-scale farming and to make the work sustainable both environmentally and economically. We have done this work with relatively little investment. I am trying now to quantify the expenses and income generated by the urban growing systems we have created. I am working with the Great Lakes Water Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to study the economics of our indoor fishing systems. With our intensive indoor sprouts and greens production, I believe I could sustain at least a half a dozen jobs on the proceeds alone, but not the larger staff that is partially funded through grants. I think if we can create low-cost forms of renewable energy, it will go a long way to making small-scale agriculture more possible for more people. The creation of a new food system that is economically viable is going to need people like Jeremy Brosowski, a graduate of an Ivy League university and the London School of Economics. His first job was as a research analyst for Goldman Sachs on Wall Street, covering beverages and tobacco. He was making good money, but he wanted to believe in the social value of what he was doing. I remember rationalizing to myself, well, we're adding liquidity to the marketplace, which is good for the economy, because we're making information readily available, he said. You can justify almost anything. He left that job by the time he was 25 to start a local business magazine called Washington Business Forward. He was soon able to open up a similar magazine in Boston, but was forced to close it in the deteriorating business climate following the attacks of September 11th. His next venture was an online business that failed during the 2008 financial crisis. By this time, Jeremy was in his mid-30s and had four children. He and his wife had a mortgage on a home in Washington, D.C. He wanted to make money, but having kids had also shifted his priorities. You look at your work differently if you filter things through the lens of, is this something my children would be proud of or care about, he said. In 2009, Jeremy came across an article about my work in the New York Times magazine. He kept talking about the piece to his wife, Beth. She told him, you need to meet this guy. Jeremy began to research other urban agriculture projects. He read about an operation in Brooklyn called the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, and he became fascinated by the idea of rooftop agriculture. He soon had dreams of fostering rooftop gardens throughout the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area. There was one big problem. He had lived in cities his whole life, and he had never grown anything more than a tomato in his backyard. He heard about my commercial urban agriculture program, and he signed up. I met Jeremy in January of 2010 on his first day at our facility. Despite our differences, I saw myself in him. He had a scientific curiosity and a head for business. I was impressed that this young man, who had spent much of his life in offices, was soon enthusiastically dumping boxes of rotten eggshells and rotting cabbages into our compost bins and asking so many questions about our worms systems. I was learning a ton, he said. By the time he arrived for the third month of the program, though, he was struggling with how to create an agricultural-based business that could survive financially. The winter of 2010 was one of the worst on record in the Northeast, and most of Washington, D.C.'s rooftops were clogged with ice and snow. It was a hard climate to sell the idea of rooftop gardens. Jeremy was watching me conduct my composting lesson on a Saturday in late March of 2010 when his thoughts drifted back to the previous day. He had made a compost run with one of my drivers in a large truck that we lease. They picked up raw materials from a bakery, a cafeteria, and several other locations. The drive time between pickups was sometimes longer than half an hour. He thought of the time and resources wasted in this process, and he was considering ways to make the trip more efficient. He suddenly remembered a business he respected in his home city of Washington, D.C. It was called Propane Taxi. If you had a gas grill in your backyard, Propane Taxi offered to come to your house and exchange your old tank instantly for a full one. The service cost about $4 more than what it cost if you disconnected the tank from the gas grill, put it in the car, drove it to Home Depot, filled it up, and returned it. The business made propane replacement effortless. Once I heard of this business, Jeremy said, I would never buy propane any other way. Jeremy started wondering whether the Propane Taxi model could be altered to fit the business of composting. He wanted to make it very easy to pick up compost from the people who were producing it, consumers and businesses, and very easy for urban farms that needed it for food production to receive it. A name came into his mind. Compost Cab. Jeremy suddenly excused himself from my workshop. He needed to write this down. He found a small empty table at the back of my front greenhouse. There, over the next 2 hours, he typed into his laptop a model for the whole business. The main premise was simple. Customers would pay to have their compost picked up, and Jeremy would deliver it for free to urban farmers. After he typed out the plan, he walked into my front store, where he could access our spotty wireless internet service, and he bought the domain compostcab.com. When Jeremy returned home to Washington, D.C., he sat his children down and explained the new business he was creating. I asked them, what if we could take our garbage and grow food in it? Any 6-year-old will tell you that is awesome, because it is awesome. So now when you ask my kids, what does your dad do? They say, my dad grows food out of garbage. By September of 2010, when he launched his business, Jeremy had signed up 37 residential customers in Washington. He had done no advertising other than putting up his website. He bought an inexpensive dump truck off of eBay. He painted it yellow, and he decorated it with a compost cab sign and checkered stickers purchased from a New York taxi supply company. Whenever a customer joined, Jeremy sent her an email welcoming her and explaining the system. He noticed that his early residential customers were overwhelmingly female. A subscription costs $32 a month. Each customer is given an airtight bucket bearing the Compost Cab logo and a compostable bag. The organic waste is collected once a week. The buckets are cleaned on the spot, and the customer is provided with a new compostable bag. He delivers the compostables to Eco City Farms on the edge of the city in Edmundston, Maryland, as well as to a small farm adjacent to a D.C. public school. He helps create the compost, too, using Growing Powers techniques. He tweets pictures of the piles and updates on their progress to followers of Compost Cab on the social network Twitter. Our residential customers are paying us to pick up their garbage in a town where garbage pickup is part of your tax base, Jeremy says. You've got to really want to do this, and our customers do. Jeremy also set up a dump site at the popular DuPont Circle Farmers Market in Washington, where people could pay him $2 to dump their organic waste. Roughly 36 people take him up on the offer each week. By late summer of 2011, Compost Cab had grown to have more than 160 residential customers, as well as a number of businesses, including offices of the Peace Corps, Bloomberg, the Financial News Company, and the kitchen of the Hyatt Regency. The only residential customers who had ended their subscriptions were people who have moved elsewhere. With the larger subscriber base, Jeremy has been able to hire a young man in his 20s, Alec Brown, to do most of the pickups. He offers him a salary of $30,000 a year. By creating one job in the middle of the economic downturn, Jeremy has done more than many of the politicians in Washington. On a balmy August day, Alec steered the yellow Compost Cab dump truck with broken air conditioning down small Washington alleyways. The fermented smell of decaying fruits and vegetables in the back, it has a tang to it, Alec said, blew in his open windows. Alec had worked on Capitol Hill, but lost his job when a Tea Party candidate defeated his Boca Raton representative in the fall 2010 elections. He began to rethink what he wanted to do with his life. Alec met Jeremy when he was volunteering at an Earth Day event. When I was on the Hill, we did amazing things, Alec said. We passed the health care bill. We reformed Wall Street. Yet we never saw the effects of those things. Whereas this is different. This compost pile is turning into dirt. On some level, I think I was tired of the macro. I wanted to do the micro. Alec hopped out of the dump truck and soon emerged from underneath the staircase of a Washington townhome with a Compost Cab bucket in hand. He unloaded the compostables in the back, cleaned the lid and the bottom of the bucket with a washcloth, and hopped back in the truck. He scribbled the weight of the compost next to a name on his list, one of 50 customers that day, and the time of the pickup. He quickly glanced at his next destination. Alec was sweating. As he drove, he was listening to National Public Radio, where two pundits were discussing the debt limit crisis on Capitol Hill. The announcer asked, "Has this impacted the U.S. standing in the world?" Alec often sees the Capitol Dome on his Compost Cab route, but his former life there feels a million miles away. Jeremy often rises at 5:30 a.m. on weekday mornings to prepare the compost pickup map for Alec. He's not taking any salary himself at this point. His wife's job provides enough at the moment that he's able to get by. He recognizes this as a luxury that many do not have, and his idealism is tempered by economic challenges. He wants to be able to franchise the model he has developed to other cities by 2012 and to take a percentage. He is committed to a for-profit model because he thinks it is the only way that the good food movement is going to succeed in the long term. This is not Google we're building, but the waste industry in this country is a $100 billion a year business, Jeremy said. Half of that belongs to 30 companies. The other half, $50 billion, belongs to 30,000 little companies across the country. Haulers, recyclers. $50 billion is a big business. If you can capture some piece of that in a way that's beneficial to everyone, that's a huge victory. 30 years ago, the recycling industry was the domain of hippies and freaks. Composting is basically where recycling was 30 years ago. It is a fringe movement that is about to become mainstream. And the reason is because there is money in it. It's only going to scale because there's a nickel in it for somebody. In the future, I think there should be room in the world for both for-profit and non-profit community food projects. Many urban agriculture initiatives, like Walnut Way's efforts in Milwaukee, have social and economic benefits that extend beyond the organization's own balance sheets. These efforts survive through the generosity of local businesses and governments who want to help the communities these projects serve. They impact people's lives and health in a positive way, and they are not reliant on federal subsidies as many farms growing commodity crops are. Derek Cunningham is proof of why nonprofit farms can matter. He first came to one of my workshops in Milwaukee in the spring of 2004. On a recent December day, Derek told his story as he wended his way with his two crutches through the rows of lettuce and spinach in a greenhouse in Lynchburg, Virginia. He was born with spina bifida, a birth defect that created a hole in his spine and left him partially paralyzed from the waist down. His parents were told when he was born in 1971 that he would likely not live past 12 years old. Derek stubbornly defied expectation. Derek and a young attorney, Michael Van Ness, had a vision. In 2003, they started a nonprofit called Lynchburg Grows, with the hopes of creating gardening programs for low-income individuals and people with disabilities. Michael and Derek's inspiration came when they helped an elderly man in the nearby town of Bedford, Paul Lamb, replant his vegetable garden. Lamb had a severe speech impediment. The garden he had carefully tended for years outside his group home had been accidentally raised. In 2004, Lynchburg Grows found a home from a local family who owned 9 large 1920s-era greenhouses in an industrial corner of Lynchburg. At one time, the family of Herman Schinkel, Jr. produced a quarter of Virginia's cut flowers there. A growing international flower market undercut the family's prices, though, forcing the Schinkels to sell their roses at 25 cents a stem rather than a dollar, and ultimately pushing the family out of a business they had kept up for 50 years. The family hoped to see the agricultural legacy of their greenhouses preserved, and they decided to sell their property to Derek, Michael, and Lynchburg Grows for well below the market rate. Volunteers from Lynchburg College helped clear the greenhouses of old rose bushes, and Derek soon started offering workshops in the greenhouses for children with special needs, including autism. He taught them how to plant and harvest kale, spinach, onions, and beets. He also began to grow food commercially and started cold calling several chefs at restaurants in the area to ask them to take his produce. In late 2006, Derek became president of Lynchburg Grows and got off Social Security. "I was receiving disability checks at the time," Derek said. "I could have stayed on disability. I didn't have to be working. But I felt like I had so much talent and motivation, and I got tired of sitting at home. I didn't want just barely to live." Derek has since helped build a formidable composting operation. It saves the city over $50,000 each year in landfill fees by taking half of the leaves the city collects. Lynchburg Grows also sells its lettuce to 4 local school systems, and Derek has formed business relationships with more than a dozen local restaurants in the city. The organization runs a farmers market that is manned by community members with both mental and physical disabilities. This work indicates how the local food movement has the potential to provide meaningful employment for people who have been shut out of the traditional workforce. Recently, I partnered with the Badger Association for the Blind, a Wisconsin organization, to teach a client of theirs how to seed sprouts in my greenhouses. The lady who visited learned the entire process within an hour, and the trays she seeded were better than many created by my experienced staff. Derek is working hard to make his organization less dependent than grant money. "We're up to at least 3 days of sustainability out of a week," Derek says, meaning that at least 3 of every 7 days are financed internally from selling food or services. Lynchburg Grows has been creative in trying to cover 4 more days. The organization recently rented one of their greenhouses to a local congregation. The church grows 2 tons of fresh food there annually for its soup kitchens, which feed fresh greens to a clientele who have often come to expect donated canned food and stale bread. Lynchburg Grows has also converted one of their extra greenhouses into an event hall for weddings. "I hope Derek can make Lynchburg Grows sustainable 7 days out of 7, but I don't see the harm if he doesn't. His nonprofit can coexist with for-profit ventures like Jeremy's Compost Cab. His organization is supported by the donations and volunteer hours of people who want to better their community and who know that there are values more important than money. I recently gave a workshop on composting at Derek's facility in March of 2010. More than 50 people learned from me about carbon and nitrogen ratios and how to grow fresh soil. Derek watched the whole time, his frail legs held up in the air by his strong upper body and his crutches. The crowd that he and his colleagues had assembled was diverse in every sense. Some of them sat in motorized wheelchairs, and some had Down syndrome. Some were black and some were white. Some were old and some were young. After I took my last questions about composting, I surveyed this crowd. They looked like what I wanted the good food movement to look like. I asked them the question I always ask when I finish my compost lesson. "Can you do this?" I said. "Yes," they said back quietly. "I can't hear you," I said. "Can you do this?" "Yes," they yelled back in unison, with fists pumped into the air. World Without Fences. I have worked with community gardening projects that don't do a good enough job of involving the garden's neighbors. "We've got to put up a fence to protect our garden," people will say. I tell them, "No, you don't. You have to do the harder work of engaging the community. You've got to make sure the neighbors know that the garden is their own, not yours." Kids in the neighborhood threw rocks at my greenhouses when I first opened in 1993, but they stopped several months after my arrival. I had not retaliated or chased them away. Instead, I invited the young people to come see what we were doing. I gave them summer jobs. Neighbors started respecting the fact that I was bringing good food into the community. They started being eyes and ears for me. The community felt ownership in our shared success. In order to build a new food system, we're going to need a world without fences. We all have a responsibility to work together. We need everyone at the table. We're going to need black and white, young and old, rich and poor. We're going to need university folks who can study and foster new organic techniques. We're going to need politicians who can help create an easier political environment and public space for a local food system. We need entrepreneurs who can create niche food products and graphic designers who can create packaging. We're going to need planners who design inner-city neighborhoods with the idea of food security in mind. We're going to need educators and nutritionists who teach people the benefits of healthy food. We're going to need architects who can retrofit old warehouses and greenhouses to the new purpose of growing food. We need contractors, composters, plumbers. Not least, we're going to need a new generation of farmers. The dream. I have the audacity to believe that people everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. Martin Luther King, Jr. Damian Coleman arrived at my facility for the first time on the last Saturday of July in 2009. He was a thin young African-American man, 21 years old, wearing a pitch-black Milwaukee Brewers baseball cap that he liked to pull down to his eyebrows. He lived with his parents and his brothers in a crowded apartment on 65th and Carmen Streets, 10 blocks from Growing Power. He had cobbled together whatever work he could find since he was 18. He had worked as a caddy at a country club, where he carried 60-pound bags for an exclusively white clientele. He had held down 2 fast food jobs, yet he was having difficulty finding full-time employment. He had applied for entry-level jobs wherever he could, Sears, General Mills. He never got an offer. "The stress was getting to me," he says. "People weren't hiring me. First of all, I'm an African-American human being, and a male at that. 2, the economy was so bad. I didn't have a criminal record. My plate was clean, and I didn't want to do no more fast food restaurants. I liked to cook, but that wasn't me." Damien had seen my roadside stand whenever he went to play basketball at a nearby park. When a friend who worked there told him about it, he decided to come by. He walked up to a compost pile and asked Sarah Christman, who was now our facilities manager as well as beekeeper, "Can I have a job?" Sarah said that there weren't any jobs at that time, but that he could come and volunteer. "Cool," Damien said. He began showing up 4 hours every day. He dressed like a gangster, but it soon became evident to everyone that there was nothing hard about him. He baked apple pie for the farm's interns. He liked to make Italian food. His mother teased him about being part Italian. His hope was that we would see he was a hard worker and offer him a position. He did whatever we asked of him, shoveling compost, sifting worm castings, hauling boxes of food waste. I did not find out until later that to try to earn a little extra money at that time, Damien was donating his blood plasma 2 times a week. He got $40 each time he donated. This allowed him to buy food and not feel like a drain on his parents. He kept applying for full-time jobs while he volunteered, but no one seemed interested. After 2 months, Karen called Damien into her office. "I heard you want a job here, Damien," Karen said, "and I heard a lot about you. I heard you've been working hard and that you've shown consistency. How many hours are you volunteering a day?"
4,
he said. "We want to give you an internship," Karen said. "You know you would have to work from 8 to 5. It's hard work. Can you do this?"
"I can do this," Damien said.
"I need a job real bad. Anything I can do, I will do it." The internship only paid $100 a week at first, though we soon made him an apprentice and paid double that. We wanted to see how he would do. Damien had told us that he was claustrophobic. He never went to parties because he feared being around a lot of people. At Growing Power, though, he was often working in tight quarters with many others, and he had learned to overcome it. He soon felt at home here. He was especially interested in soil production, and he spent most of his time working with the compost. "I was liking the job," he said. "The environment was good. I loved the hard work. I was on my feet every day. And it's a different thing every day. You're not sitting at a desk all day or standing there taking customer orders." Several months later, I called Damien into my office along with Karen and Sarah Christman. Damien had looked nervous after I asked him for this meeting. He wasn't sure if he was going to be reprimanded or if something good was going to happen. We started the meeting by telling him that we liked what he was doing, but that there were some areas where we felt he needed to improve. He took in what we were saying, and he said he agreed, and he would work on his problem spots. Then I told him that since he had been here, we had never had better compost or soil production. I said that I appreciated his work. "Are you willing to join us as full-time staff?" I said.
"Yes," Damien said. "Of course I will. Thank you. I won't let you down. You'll never regret it. I promise you won't."
He shook our hands as he left. His smile was as wide as Kansas. With the economy the way it is, I realized I needed to show consistency, Damien told me later. I needed to show that this is what I wanted to do. In the summer of 2010, I was giving a tour of our greenhouses with Damien's help. I had leaned a fishing rod against one of our fish systems, and I decided to teach him how to catch a tilapia in front of the dozen or so people who were following me. I helped him thread a worm onto the hook and showed him how to cast the line gently. Damien soon had a large tilapia tugging passionately on the hook, and he reeled it in. When I was helping him remove the fish from the hook, a tear rolled down Damien's cheek. He began wiping his eyes with his arm, embarrassed at himself. "Me and my dad don't see eye to eye," he explained later. "He left when I was 5. That was actually the happiest day of my life. I always wanted to fish with my dad, and I never got the chance." When you work in agriculture and with young people, it makes you think quite a bit about the future. You have to imagine the world you want to create before there is any evidence you can bring it into being.
I think about driving my pickup truck through Milwaukee 100 years from now, long after I have passed away. I see changes. In the city's low-income neighborhoods like Arlington Heights and Haven Woods, I see people who are growing fresh vegetables intensively in their backyards. I drive past waste trucks that are in the business of composting, a practice that has become mandatory for urban residents along with recycling. These companies collect organics and paper, and they sell the soil they create to farmers. I see 15-acre for-profit farms that are zoned into cities. They are considered as a necessary part of urban infrastructure as the sewer and water systems. These farms have cafes and cooperative grocery stores where people can buy locally grown food at affordable prices. At farmers' markets, I see that the future equivalent of the food stamps program offers people 3 times more buying power there than at corner stores. I see fast food restaurants that find it necessary to ensure that the animals used in their products are treated humanely, that their food is sourced locally, and that they do not create products that harm the health of the people who are their patrons. Urban hospitals have greenhouses to raise fresh vegetables. The fresh food is harvested and served the same day on patients' dinner plates, fulfilling the Greek physician Hippocrates' wish that food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food. I drive by post-secondary schools that teach young people the science of intensive agriculture. When the students graduate, they are called agriculturalists. This has become a respected profession, and the work pays well enough to afford a decent middle-class existence. I see former industrial buildings that have been turned into fish and vegetable factories and that are powering themselves by solar panels, food waste biodigesters, and clean forms of energy not yet invented. Many of these businesses are owned and operated by people of color. As I drive out of Milwaukee, I see small farmers with multiple crops that exist on the perimeter of the city. With the help of high-quality compost, they are growing sprouts and microgreens in hoop houses, providing their families year-round food and a modest income. In the summer, they are able to grow row crops. They sell to community food centers and high-end restaurants within a 25-mile drive of their home. Finally, I drive past 55th and Silver Spring Drive, where my dream began in 1993. I see our original farm stand, much as it stood a century before. Directly next to it, though, is a gleaming 5-story structure. It is known as the first vertical farm of its kind in the world. It has tiered greenhouses that absorb natural light and capture rainfall, recirculating the water inside the farm to irrigate the plants and to replenish the fish systems. The building is not connected to the energy grid. It is run by the power of the sun and by food waste and other biological forms of energy. Inside, young farmers from around the country are learning the latest intensive urban agriculture techniques in our growing spaces and classrooms. Planners come to learn how to build food-secure communities. Academics and agriculturalists share their latest research. Local mothers and young African-American men and women take free classes in our commercial kitchen, and they come away knowing how to cook simple, healthy meals at home with real ingredients. They shop in our retail store on the lower level, where we offer affordable fresh greens, picked that same day from only a few feet away. I recently began a capital campaign to try to raise the money to build this vertical farm. An award-winning local design firm, Kubala Washatko Architects, has finished preliminary drawings that express our vision. The City of Milwaukee's Planning Commission passed an order with an unanimous vote to change the area's zoning to allow for a structure of this size in our residential neighborhood. Our first donations for the vertical farm have come in small increments, $25 or $50, from people in our community who hope to see us succeed. I hope this building will provide a legacy that will ensure the survival of my organization and its mission when I am gone. When I think of this hopeful future, I see a world that has regained a proper balance between manual and intellectual work. For decades, we have taught our young people to pursue jobs that use the mind, but not the body. We have segregated our exercise
to the sterile environment of the gym. We have made people spend entire years at work moving nothing but their steering wheel, their mouse, or a cursor. We no longer teach many manual trades in high schools. We encourage many of our best and our brightest young people to go into think tanks or into law. We were not made to sit in cubicles or stare at screens or papers all day. My most intimate and lasting learning experiences have come not through books or computers, but through my patient interaction with the land. The work of creating a new food system will offer work that engages both the spirit and the body. It will allow people the satisfaction of seeing and tasting the results of their labor. It will require the cultivation of human relationships that are off the grid, as well as an attitude of respect toward the natural world. This movement, this good food revolution, as I like to call it, will demand the best efforts of our hearts, bodies, and minds. The revolution has already begun. A few years ago, I told my staff that I wanted to host a gathering in Milwaukee that would help build the local food movement. I decided to call the gathering the National International Urban and Small Farm Conference. I hoped such an impressive name would draw an impressive crowd. In reality, I wasn't sure who would come. My idea was to bring together people from across the country who are working to build a new food system and to allow them to share ideas and to build relationships. When we opened our conference at the Wisconsin State Fairgrounds on September 10, 2010, I looked out on a crowd of 1,000 people who had come from across the United States and from more than a dozen countries. The state fair sits near an ancient Indian burial site, and I felt there was something sacred about the space. I'm really happy today. As I look out at this mass of humanity, I said in my opening remarks, many of you I know and have been friends with in this good food revolution. But as I look out, I also see a lot of new faces. What especially encourages me is that I see a lot of young folks. I see a multicultural group that really reflects what our country is all about. The conference offered more than 30 different breakaway sessions where visitors could learn about water chemistry for indoor fish production, wind energy, and organic pest control. They could learn to make biodiesel from restaurant grease or to farm safely on former industrial sites. They could hear from Malik Yakini about the future of urban agriculture in Detroit, or learn from the experiences of Richard Cates, who started the Wisconsin School for Beginning Dairy and Livestock Farmers. Richard's school has graduated more than 400 new farmers since it was founded in 1996. Deshaun Parker was the chef for the conference, and he stage managed a staff of more than 20 people. On September 11th, an afternoon breakaway session brought together young people who had worked for Growing Power's Youth Corps. One by one, the young people spoke of their experiences at Growing Power and the lessons they took from their time there. Unexpectedly, Karen's daughter, Deshelle, asked to speak at the end of the session. When she first took the microphone, she spoke quietly, but her voice gained strength as she continued. "My name is Deshelle Parker," she began. "I am Karen Parker's daughter. I am also the sister of Deshaun Parker, and he's responsible for all the food you're eating. He is in school now for the culinary arts. When I was 14, my mom said that Will was going to open up a store," Deshelle continued. "She said that she was going to help run it with him. She said she was going to be working hard for a long time and that she was going to move us into the house next door so she could keep an eye on us. That essentially meant to me at 14 that I wasn't going to be able to do nothing. Then on top of that, I was expected to work harder than others," she continued. "Work was right next door. I've got to get up and work every day, after school and on weekends. I'm bookkeeping. I'm customer servicing. I'm fronting the shelves. I'm stocking. I'm unloading trucks, and I'm loading trucks. And I think my mama done lost her mind. And I think that Will is the most unreasonable man in the world. I can't wait to get grown and go to college." "I didn't like farming," Deshelle said,
But if you look at the youth who came through here, you see what we're doing now in the community. One of us is a supervisor at the Milwaukee County Board. Another is on the board of Growing Power. We have a Youth Corps member who works for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And you have me. I built a career in social work, giving back to children in foster care. I help provide market baskets to foster parents, pulling in my past with Growing Power. And I stand before you today not only certified in social work in the state of Wisconsin, but with 2 master's degrees. You ask me, what does Growing Power mean to me now, at 31? It means integrity. It means strong thinking. It means willpower. It means confidence. It means assertiveness. It's so far beyond dirt and worms. Deschelle asked her 8-year-old daughter, Halea, to come up beside her. Deschelle said that she had been bringing Halea with her to Growing Power since she was an infant. The young girl, who refers to me as Big Papa Will, recently told Deschelle that she wanted to be a farmer and a chef when she grows up. I was one of her 2 role models. The other was her Uncle Deshaun. The graduation for our 2010 commercial urban agriculture students was held the same summer that Deschelle gave this speech. We conducted the ceremony in a tent pitched in the parking lot between Growing Power's greenhouses and Karen Parker's house. 200 other people were in attendance as part of our weekend workshop program. One of the most dedicated students of the commercial urban agriculture class was Greg Thompson, an Atlanta-based chef for the Steve Harvey Project, a show on Black Entertainment Television. Greg had noticed how hard Deshaun worked in the kitchen. He also noticed that Deshaun didn't wear a chef coat when he cooked, only his Growing Power t-shirt. Greg reached out to Michelle Thomas, a Washington-based physician who was also in the class, and they hatched a plan together. They had 2 chef coats embroidered for Deshaun. One had Deshaun's name and the Growing Power logo, and the other had just Deshaun's name, in case he could use it for private catering work. Karen and I knew that Greg and Michelle planned to honor Deshaun, but we pledged to keep the news a secret. Soon before we sent our graduates home, I called all of my staff members to the front of our tent to recognize them. I briefly thanked them all. Finally, I asked Deshaun to come forward. Karen nudged her son toward me. He looked at me with shy and confused eyes. All morning, everybody kept telling me to be on my best behavior, Deshaun said later. You told me that. My mom's telling me that. I'm like, what's going on? Have I not been good? Though his face was still scarred from the fire, it was remarkable to me how handsome Deshaun had become. He was 24 now. In the last 2 years, I'd felt that he held himself with greater confidence, and he was polite and attentive to strangers. I told the audience that there would now be a special presentation. Greg Thompson came to the front and stood beside Deshaun and me. I handed Greg the microphone. The definition of a chef is someone who is skilled in the art of preparing food, Greg said. Deshaun, you've shown great skill in cooking for us. We recognize that you are still in culinary school, but in the eyes of everyone in our class, you are already a chef. We are presenting these to you as a small token of our appreciation. Greg extended the 2 folded chef's coats. Deshaun looked at Greg with confusion, and then with surprised gratitude. Deshaun fought tears and lost. He hugged Greg. As Deshaun unfolded one of the coats, everyone assembled in the tent rose and gave him a standing ovation. He looked out at the crowd and absorbed the attention, accepting it. It was a wonderful moment in my life, Deshaun explained later. I felt so special. I had never won anything. I have never tried to be competitive. I'd rather give than receive. After I got home, I tried to stop crying, but I kept going for, like, the next 5 hours. Deshaun graduated with a culinary degree from Milwaukee Area Technical College in 2010, and he began work at Meritage, one of Milwaukee's best restaurants. By the time you hear these words, he will be the lead chef at a new cafe that Growing Power is opening on Milwaukee's Martin Luther King Boulevard. The cafe will bring fresh food to a neighborhood that has struggled with crime and that has long been a food desert. Deshaun only wears his chef's coat on special occasions because he is afraid to get it dirty. "I'm okay," Deshaun told me recently. "I got some bumps and hills here and there, but nothing I can't manage." In the last decade, my body has begun to betray me. The end game of years of the pounding my body took on basketball courts. I have had surgery recently to replace one of my knees, and in November of 2011, I had another surgery to resurface my left hip. Before my hip surgery, I could often walk only in halting steps. When I got into my pickup truck, I had to grab my left leg with my left arm in order to haul it in. I started taking pain relievers several times a day, as well as large supplements of vitamin D, which a friend recommended to me to help my immune system. I have been in the unusual position with my staff of giving orders, but no longer being able to work too long side by side with them. I have increasingly spent my time traveling the country and trying to do my part to build the local food movement. I feel urgency to do this work. I know myself to be lucky. I have had the advantage of a good family and people who have believed in me. If you start in the middle of a rough neighborhood, and with a broken family, it is difficult just to be a functioning person. It is tough to get up in the morning. It is hard not to be overwhelmed and not be disillusioned about the gap between the person you are and the person you hope to be. It is hard to be scared you're not going to have enough to pay your rent or put food on your table. It is hard to have a family that leans too hard, or to be in a joyless or abusive relationship, or to have a criminal record because of something you did when you were too young to know better, or to have chosen the wrong path because a straighter path seemed to offer no opportunity. It is hard to have people look at your skin and make assumptions about you before you have a chance to prove them wrong. It is difficult to suffer the health consequences of a diet you didn't know could damage you so much until it was too late. A better food system will not fix all these problems. It won't heal everyone. But if we can take control of the food environment in our inner-city communities, and if we can knit together the broken fabric between local farmers and our cities, and repair the damaged urban land, and grow fresh soil and food there, it can provide a chance for people to have lives with greater dignity. Access to reasonably priced, healthy, fresh food provides a defense against the dehumanizing and debilitating effects of diabetes and other food-related illness. A better diet will allow our young people to find more joy in their own bodies and in their minds. Growing food intensively in cities and on the edge of cities will offer the chance for new kinds of work. Creating opportunities for local farmers to connect to urban communities can help heal an emotional rift between the countryside and the ghetto. Not least, planting a small garden in your yard can provide the self-respect of being a little more self-sufficient in a world where we often are made to feel the powerless victims of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or the rise and fall of oil prices, or the employment market, or the fates of large corporations. My model for the food system can't feed the world right now, yet it is helping to feed neighborhoods one at a time. It is nurturing communities. Together with others who share my hopes, we are changing the food system block by block, hoop house by hoop house. Join us. Pick up a shovel. Get your hands dirty. And let's begin. This concludes The Good Food Revolution by Will Allen with Charles Wilson. Narrated by Myron Willis, member of SAG-AFTRA. Copyright 2012 by William E. Allen. This unabridged audiobook is recorded by arrangement with Avery.
an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.